They were a small party charged with going where no one from the outside world had ever gone, to open one of the last great wilderness regions of Earth, a place they thought might still hold woolly mammoths and other prehistoric creatures.
You've probably heard this story before, whether in school or in documentaries like this one from National Geographic. In 1804, when Lewis and Clark set out from St. Louis to explore the mysterious West, they had no idea what they would find.
To find out what was really out there, and to survive, was the equivalent in its day of a journey to the moon.
Well, today when we think of the Midwest and our view from the highway, we probably think of endless farms and a few cities. But what Lewis and Clark saw on the plains was more like the Serengeti in Africa, filled with millions of bison, wolves, and grizzly bears. Our guest today has painted a detailed picture of what this region looked like in the early 19th century. I'm Brian Ellison. Welcome to Central Standard. And Dan Flores, welcome to you.
Hello, Brian. I'm proud to be here.
Really glad to have you. So your book is called American Serengeti, making reference to that diverse area of African wildlife. Is that really an apt comparison?
I think it's absolutely an apt comparison. The American Great Plains for several million years was the closest analog to the Serengeti, the Maasai Mara, the Veld of South Africa, of any place on Earth. And it existed in that form right up until a little more than a century ago. So it was a remarkable place, one of the grand spectacles of life anywhere on the planet.
So the subtitle of the book is The Last Big Animals of the Great Plains. Paint us that picture. Let's imagine it's 200 years ago. Maybe you are Lewis or Clark, like in the documentary, or you're John James Audubon, who you write about. You find yourself heading up the Missouri River, venturing out into what today we call Kansas or Nebraska. What would you have seen out there?
Well, Lewis and Clark and Audubon and many others left us really wonderful literary descriptions of this region that are really evocative of something that we simply don't get to see in North America in our own times, except perhaps in a place like the Lamar Valley of Yellowstone National Park. That's almost the only vignette that still exists for us, at least in the lower 48. But these people saw a world that we have to put together in our minds largely through their descriptive abilities. And Audubon, for example, who went up the Missouri River in 1843, said that the mind simply can't conceive of the numbers and the variety of animals that he was able to see from the prow of the steam vessel called the Omega that he was taking up the Missouri River in that year. So, they were stunned. And Audubon and Lewis and Clark both were, they were all people who were very familiar with American nature, and yet they were absolutely gobsmacked by what they got to see on the Great Plains.
Well, what did they see? I mean, when you say there's no way to conceive of those numbers, what kind of numbers are we talking about?
Well, we're first talking about a Serengeti that was a fairly recent version in terms of long dura history. It was about a 10,000-year-old version of the American Great Plains. And the reason for that is because about 10,000 years ago, roughly speaking, as a result of what are called the Pleistocene extinctions, many of the very large animals, the African analogs like mammoths and mastodons and hunting hyenas and saber-toothed cats, had become extinct. So we had a version of the Serengeti that existed over the last 10,000 years that had fewer animals, fewer extremely large animals, but nonetheless a very impressive kind of Serengeti-like setting. And what these people saw were bison herds that probably in years of good climate went as high as 25, perhaps 30 million animals. They saw... Yes,
and they saw pronghorns. To imagine that.
They saw pronghorns that were as numerous as 15 million on the Great Plains, probably 1 to 2 million gray wolves. No one knows how many coyotes, but Millions of them, there's no question. We think probably as many as 50,000 grizzly bears were working the Great Plains in the time when there were buffalo there. And there were also, interestingly enough, probably as many as 2 million wild horses on the Great Plains 200 years ago.
I want to take apart each of those animals at some point here during our conversation, but it is interesting that you mention that is actually the evolutionary aftermath of what once would have looked much more like the African Serengeti, right?
Yeah, and that's right. Yes, the elephants were gone, for example. We had lost the elephants in the Pleistocene extinctions, and as I mentioned, we had lost the saber-toothed cats, and we had a lion on the Great Plains, a very large steppe lion. But those animals had gone, but we had animals like, for example, the grizzly bears that sort of played a lion-like role as hunters and scavengers on the plains. So a lot of the niches ended up getting filled by these later animals.
And where did they go, by the way? Where did that earlier generation from the Pleistocene go? What happened to them?
Well, we think probably for a number of reasons, and I will say it's one of the grand mysteries of American ecological history to try to determine exactly what happened to those animals. We think that probably the elephants were hunted out by the first arrivals from Asia who encountered a North American bestiary that had no experience with human hunters before. Hmm. And so that's probably what happened to the mastodons and the mammoths. Some of the other animals, it's more difficult to try to figure it out. I mean, one of the ones that to me is one of the great mysteries of North America were the wild horses, which at one time, 10, 15,000 years ago, constituted as much as 20 to 25% of the biomass of the Great Plains. And those animals, having migrated to Asia and Africa where they survived, somehow all became extinct in North America. And that is a mystery no one has satisfactorily explained.
You mentioned pronghorns. I'm not familiar with the pronghorn. What kind of animal was this?
Well, the pronghorn is what Lewis and Clark thought it was. For example, when they first saw them, they said this is an animal like the gazelle of Africa. It struck them as being a kind of an analog of small gazelles like the Thompson's gazelles of the Serengeti. Mm. They're actually an American evolved family of animals that has some relationship, we think, perhaps in the dim past to giraffes. But they struck a lot of people who saw them as very, very fast. Lewis and Clark said, Meriwether Lewis said, watching them run is like watching birds fly across the landscape. They move so rapidly. So they were antelope of the American plains.
And you've written a lot about these animals. In fact, your book devotes a chapter to each one of these that you've mentioned. I think we're sort of familiar, at least we imagine we're familiar with what bison are like, but and we can picture them out there on the grasslands. Grizzly bears are a lot harder to conceive of roaming the prairies.
They are harder to conceive of because our experience with grizzly bears in the past century has been that they are animals of the high mountains, and that's largely a result of where the surviving grizzlies escaped to at the end of the 19th century. But as long as there were bison on the Great Plains, grizzly bears ranged as far out on the plains as Kansas, Nebraska, West Texas. These were animals that, as you cross the highways of the plains today, you have to imagine that only 125 or 150 years ago, there very easily could have been a grizzly bear walking by you at some distance, probably close to the river systems. But they largely worked up and down the rivers of the plains, and one of the things that attracted them was the availability of bison that drowned in the rivers or crashed through the ice, and so they scavenged on the carcasses of those animals.
So you mentioned the writings of Lewis and Clark and of Audubon, and one of the effects of those writings that it inspired a lot of other people to come out and see this for themselves. What were those early interactions like between European settlers or visitors with the wildlife of the Great Plains?
Well, one of the early groups of people who came out that I described early in the book were European elites, basically from the nobility class of England, of Ireland, of Scotland, of indeed Russia even. And what they were doing was participating in what soon came to be called the safari. And so the safari, I mean, we think of it as a result of films like Out of Africa, for instance, mm-hmm. as purely kind of an African experience. But this happened in North America, and the place that was targeted for these high-end safari experiences by very wealthy Europeans was not the Rocky Mountains, where we would think today the animals would be, but in fact it was these open grasslands, very much as in East Africa. And so starting in the 1830s, people like William Drummond Stewart, for example, who was a Scottish nobleman, and a few years later, Sir George Gore, who was an Irish nobleman. And finally, by the 1870s, the son of the Tsar of Russia, Duke Alexei of Russia, all came out and conducted grand safaris that would go on for months and involve sometimes hundreds of people, so-called white hunters, who were often folks like George Armstrong Custer or Philip Sheridan would be their guides, and sometimes native people like Spotted Tail of the Lakotas would guide some of these hunters. And they participated in what we would think of today as a purely kind of African experience, but it happened on the American Great Plains in places like today's Kansas and Nebraska and Wyoming.
And these were not, of course, photo safaris. There was bloodshed.
Oh, it was an absolute blood sport. Sir George Gore, who was on the Powder River in 1855, had an entourage that, in the descriptions of his safari, he had so many, more than 100 hunting horses, as many as 25 dogs, hundreds of retainers of all ethnicities. And they would, when they traveled across the landscape, this party would spread out across as much as a mile or 2 miles of the prairies with all their wagons and taxidermy labs. And in the space of a few months, I mean, this guy alone, he slept till noon every day. And so everybody had to sit around and camp and wait for him to get up. But once he started hunting, he killed more than 2,500 bison and more than 60 grizzly bears in the space of just a few months.
Wow, 2,500 bison. What did he do with all of the meat?
Well, they were eating some of it in the camp because they had a party that consisted of more than 150 people. But so they were consuming some of it, but a lot of it they threw to their dogs. They left for the wolves and the coyotes. I mean, the goal was to enjoy the sport, and they didn't worry too much about the fact that animals, of course, weren't dying in sport. They were dying in earnest, and so they simply shot down the animals that pleased them and basically shot everything they could find, to a point where the local native people, the Crows and the Lakotas, got so angry about it that Gore had to call off the safari and sort of make a quick break for civilization because the Indians had become hostile about all the animals he was killing.
Well, you're mentioning the Native Americans. I'm curious about their role in the changing face of animal life in the Great Plains. We hear sometimes about the relationship between Native Americans and the buffalo, for example, or the bison. But what is to what degree did Native American peoples relate differently with the animals than the white settlers who came?
Well, I think one thing you can say from the outset is that Native people had coexisted with this last version of the American Serengeti, the one I've been describing, for at least 8 or 9 or 10,000 years without diminishing the numbers of those animals. And in some respects, I think that's the result of the fact that animals like bison and pronghorns were actually ecologically better adapted to the Great Plains than humans ever were able to be. And so the human populations remain relatively small on the plains, and you have a period of 8,000 or 10,000 years of people who hunted bison without drawing down their numbers, and so it's a very ancient and long sustainable life way. But what sort of begins to change it is the arrival of Europeans who bring a couple of things to the American West that changed the dynamic. And one of those things is the reintroduction of the horse, which had survived in Europe and in the Old World, and upon being returned to North America is going to be phenomenally successful, and an animal that native people adopt that enables them to adapt a lot better to the plains. And the other thing that the Europeans introduce, of course, is the market economy. And ultimately, almost all people, all native people in North America, and particularly those on the Great Plains, get caught up in it.
And how did that actually then play out? What was the trajectory of decline that led us from 25 to 30 million bison in herds to, to none?
Well, it's a sequence of causes in the 19th century that almost constitutes a kind of a perfect storm. Part of it is the arrival of the market economy. That's probably the most important thing, where both Americans and native people are caught up in this global exchange of the products of the wildlife on the Great Plains for metalware. And in the case of Indian people, they're interested, of course, in guns and in ammunition and all kinds of ultimately kind of even luxury goods. Just like people everywhere around the world, these are economically minded people, and so they're interested in these kinds of objects from the market. But once the global market arrives, it's augmented by the fact that you have horses once again returning to the Great Plains in large numbers, and they eat the same grass and drink the same water that bison eat, for example. So you began to see a drawdown in bison numbers as a result of the increase in the number of horses. And then finally, you have this phenomenon in the middle of the 19th century where the weather begins to change. We had a period of about 300 years before 1850 of very wet conditions on the Great Plains that basically was caused by what's known as the Little Ice Age. And when the Little Ice Age begins to fall away, it produces a series of droughts in the middle of the 19th century, and those droughts draw down the carrying capacity for grazing animals especially to an extent that by the time of the Civil War, especially by the end of the Civil War, there probably were only about 10 million bison left on the Great Plains out of what had been maybe 25 or 30 million at the beginning of the 19th century.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dan Flores about the American Serengeti, our own Great Plains. We'll look a little more at how they appeared in the past, and then we'll turn to how they might look in the future. Can a couple centuries of destruction and change be turned around, and should they? I'm Brian Ellison. KCUR Central Standard returns in just a moment. I'm Brian Ellison. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. We're talking about the Great Plains today with Dan Flores. He wrote the book American Serengeti. He's a retired professor joining us today from a studio in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where he now lives. Dan, you know, we've been talking about the destruction that occurred and occurred fairly rapidly on the Great Plains. A lot of countries with extensive wildlife create game reserves or wildlife refuges or something to preserve the animal life. It seems like that might make sense even from a market economy standpoint. Did anyone propose such a thing as this area was being devastated as the 19th century went on?
Not really. I think what pretty much happens in the period after the Civil War, as the country begins to turn its attention to the west, is that the Great Plains, because it's an open grassland that doesn't have to be cleared of trees, becomes a target, really, of the homesteading frontier and of the establishment of large ranches. And so the Plains is seen as a kind of, in a way, by the 1880s and 1890s, it's seen as a victim of the inevitable march of civilization and progress. And so one of the ways to affect that is to get rid of all these animals, to get rid of all the bison, all the pronghorns, the wolves, the grizzly bears. And in effect, the only thing that needs to happen is that you just need to let the market economy go ahead and do its work. And so this is a time, after all, the Gilded Age in the 19th century, when there are no government regulations against environmental abuse of any kind. Efforts to pass laws to protect these animals in the 1870s at the national level go nowhere. And so the market basically is going to effect the largest destruction of animal life discoverable anywhere in modern world history. All that wildlife richness that had stunned people like John James Audubon by the 1880s and 1890s is practically all gone.
Yeah, and you're assigning a bit more reason, I think, to that movement now than you do even in your book. You said what we did to the Great Plains was not some admirable conquest. It was a myopic, chaotic, unthinking destruction, and I think immoral. What do you mean by immoral?
Well, I think I'm using the term morality in this sense, not in a religious idea of morality, but in sort of the original notion of morality as the evolution of an idea that functions for a social species like human beings, where the golden rule, you treat everyone as you expect yourself to be treated, is the operative condition for a sense of morality. And so I think to walk into this landscape that had been inhabited by these animals for at least 10,000 years, and for some of those animals by much longer, and just wipe them out for purely selfish, greedy reasons, which is how, of course, the market economy was working at that time with no sort of regulation of it, was an immoral act. I mean, we let people, many of them, to be sure, folks who had survived the Civil War, their farms were destroyed. The only way they had to make money was to go out with rifles and shoot down these animals for profit. But the country basically let it happen and sort of turned their head the other way. And so I think it was a really kind of an unthinking and definitely a chaotic and almost pathetic enterprise in 19th century American history. And then when it was over, we sort of turned our heads away and said, well, it was inevitable. This is what civilization does, and set about remaking the Great Plains into some model based on European kind of settlement.
Was it inevitable? Do you think it was? Could it have gone any other way?
Well, it wasn't inevitable because we have the example in Africa where the colonial powers did not let this happen. Great Britain, for example, in its colonies in Eastern Africa, managed to get the creation of places like Serengeti National Park and the Masai Mara National Preserve. And in South Africa, the Boers, the Dutch population there, ultimately created Kruger National Park out of the veld. So we have the example in another part of the world where there was a very similar kind of landscape and a similar bestiary of these dramatic animals, where far-thinking conservationists at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century tried to create preserves to make sure that those animals survived. Whereas on the American Great Plains, no one other than a painter named George Catlin, as far back as 1832, who proposed the idea of the national park. And actually, he said, our first grand national park should be on the Great Plains to preserve this wonderful spectacle of animals. But beyond that, no one made any serious proposals for preserving this in American history.
Well, and you mentioned that in your book, you talk about how the national parks got built around tall things, mountains and right. or canyons, yeah. Deep things, but not around flat places like the Great Plains, where perhaps it would have really had an impact on preserving these animal populations.
The American national parks were largely based out of a European and American aesthetic in the 19th century that tended to invest vertical landscapes with sacred qualities. And so coming out of that Northern European experience, a lot of Americans thought of places like the Rockies and the Sierra Nevadas and the Cascades and ultimately vertical places like the Grand Canyon and the great parks of Utah as the places that should be our sacred American national parks. And the efforts in the early 20th century to try to do something similar on the Great Plains in a lot of ways came a little bit too late, because at that point what had made the Great Plains special, its wildlife, was already gone. And so you had this kind of runeless slate where all the characters had been removed. And so efforts to create great game parks on the American Great Plains, and there were some in the 1920s and 1930s, all really kind of came to naught.
Well, plus you had an economic change, which was that this was now, a lot of it, farmland owned and being cultivated, right?
That's right. It became, unlike the part of the West from the Rockies westward, where you ended up with a lot of federally owned land in the form of national forests, national parks, ultimately Bureau of Land Management tracts, so that in those regions of the West, sometimes as much as 50-60% of the landscape is in public ownership, the Great Plains ended up almost all completely privatized. And so that made it increasingly difficult when you get into the 20th century to try to create some sort of nature preserves or great game parks, because now you have to reacquire the land from private landowners.
So are there efforts then to turn back the clock on this, to repopulate the Great Plains in some way, to turn some of this land wild again? What would that require?
I think someone who approaches reading my American Serengeti book is likely to think, oh boy, this is really going to be an environmental bummer. This is how we've destroyed nature, and it's going to make me really dejected. But in fact, this actually has an uplifting ending, because there is an organization in Montana today called the American Prairie Reserve, discovering that in the state of Montana on the northern plains, there are vast stretches of intact grasslands and more public lands left on the Great Plains in the north than there are, for example, in Kansas and Nebraska and farther south, that there really is a possibility of doing this. So the American Prairie Reserve, starting in about 2000, just at the beginning of the 21st century, began putting together a project where they are trying to create a 3.5 million acre reconstituted American Serengeti on the Middle Missouri River. And what they're attempting to do is to combine two existing pieces, very large pieces of public lands, one of them the Upper Missouri National Monument, Upper Missouri Breaks National Monument, and the other one the Charles M. Russell National Wildlife Refuge, which are both along the Missouri. And they're trying to acquire, as they come up for sale, the private ranches that are in between and connect these two pieces of public lands, with the idea of ultimately managing to recreate this American Serengeti, reintroduce all these animals that were once on the Great Plains. It's really the most exciting conservation project in the American West right now.
You know, I have to ask you, Dan, you taught in the mountains of Montana. You retired to high desert southwest in New Mexico. What is it that captivates you about the Great Plains and the history of this region?
Well, I grew up in Louisiana, which is about as much of a base reversal from the Great Plains as it's possible
even,
to get.
Even more than the mountains and the high desert.
Even more than the Rockies of Missoula, Montana. I grew up in a place where you couldn't see 75 feet because of the density of the forest. And there was something about the open landscapes. I mean, it's almost like, I think for a lot of people, it's almost like a genetic memory of our evolutionary home in Africa. And as a 17-year-old, having my parents let me drive off for a weekend, I immediately drove from Louisiana off across West Texas and Oklahoma to New Mexico and Colorado. And I have never forgotten my excitement when the night fell on that first day's drive, and I began seeing the lights of towns 30 and 40 miles away, because I'd grown up in a place where you couldn't see 100 yards. You had to round a bend through the forest to see a town. And I found being able to see that sort of openness to be an extremely exciting a feeling that, you know, I couldn't quite explain, but I have suspected ever since probably had something to do with almost kind of a genetic memory of these sort of open places where we spent a lot of our early evolution as a species. And, of course, the plains I saw didn't have the animals in place, but it's hard not to imagine what they would be like with those animals returned.
Yeah. So my last question, Dan, I was fascinated. Of all the animals you talked about, one has really been the survivor in the region, and that's coyotes, or coyotes, if you prefer.
Yes.
No amount of so-called civilization has been able to stamp them out. In fact, they often are problems for even for cities. Why is that?
Well, I was so fascinated by the coyote story that I did in American Serengeti that I've ended up writing a separate book on coyotes. It's called Coyote America.
Well, give us the 30-second version of that book.
Yeah, it's basically a biography of the species from their evolution in the canid family 5 million years ago in North America to their manifest destiny. They're spread across North America and now into all of our major cities. And I argue the reason they're able to do it is because they have a lot of evolutionary adaptations that are very similar to our own. And that makes them, like us, one of the world's great successful species.
Well, you can check out that book as well as one we've been talking about here. This has been author Dan Flores we've been talking with, author of American Serengeti. He's professor emeritus at the University of Montana, and he joined us from Santa Fe, New Mexico, where he now lives. Dan, thank you so much.
Oh, it was a great pleasure. Thank you.